This podcast is In the Loop, the Legion of Osiris podcasts. Osiris is creating a community that connects people like you with live experiences and podcasts about artists and topics you love. Get in the loop at osirispod.com.
I'm Ben Sawyer, and this is The Road to Now. Today's episode is entitled How to Talk to a Science Denier with our guest, Dr. Lee McIntyre. He's written a book on this topic that's coming out at the end of the month. If you are looking at the title of this episode, or you just found out what it is when you autoplayed it, I realize that some of you guys may not feel like you have the energy for it. I know that in the last few years, we've seen the science denial be a problem with climate change. I know we have seen that edge become even sharper with the folks who have refused to acknowledge the weight of the coronavirus and the way their actions relate to that. But I want you to stick with this conversation because it's really important. It covers the ways that science deniers reason, and I know some of you guys are going, that's not reason, okay, but there's such a thing as rational ignorance. And if you can understand the principles from which someone starts and the way that they think about things, then it can help you understand how to relate to them. Now, for anybody who's screamed science at people and they haven't listened, I also want to say that there's an important part about how to interact with people here as well. As you've heard me say a lot of times on this podcast, if you don't show love to people, it's hard to imagine that they're going to listen to you. And it's hard to get through the anger and the frustration sometimes. I know, again, I'm not saying at all that this is not something that's very serious. But if you can find the common ground, really, as Lee says here, it's the only hope. If we're going to stop the denial that has really hamstrung us during this pandemic and threatens to continue to be a problem and perhaps an even bigger one in the future. So please listen to this. Think about it. Let us know what you think when the book comes out on August 31st from MIT Press. Pick it up. And, you could walk away from this disagreeing with it totally. That's okay. Again, we still love you. We still will listen. So, yeah, I hope you guys enjoy this. And I hope it gets you thinking as hard about this issue as it has gotten me since I read the book and had this conversation with Lee. I also want to say a real quick shout out to Solomon Daniels down at Podcast Place in Long Beach, California. I think as some of you guys know, I've been out here visiting family. I didn't have a place to record and drove down there and checked out a studio. And he was very accommodating. In fact, went beyond the call of duty to allow me to use his personal studio in his recording space. Really kind guy. And we'll be going back there if I record more in Long Beach. So shout out to those guys. I'd like to support the small businesses that go out of their way to help us out. Also want to tell you guys, I'm in Long Beach right now. As you guys know, Bob and I are all over the place. So, hey, if you guys want to see us live, we'd love to have you. The Avett Brothers have a lot of dates coming up, and especially they're hitting the Midwest. So on August 6th, they're going to be playing the Hinterland Music Festival in St. Charles, Iowa. On August 7th, they're going to be playing Stevens Field in Madison, Wisconsin with Willie Nelson. And August 8th, they will be playing in Green Bay, Wisconsin at the Retch Plaza. So go check those guys out. All of their tour dates are at theavettbrothers.com. They're coming to Wilmington, North Carolina. They've got a lot of shows coming up, in fact, all over the country. So if you haven't seen Bob's band, which maybe you have, and if you have, you're probably going to go see them if they're new anyway. But if not, go give them a chance. Check them out. I promise you, they put on a great show. I have seen them many times, and it never disappoints. Somehow they keep getting better anyway. I know I say that all the time. But yeah, also, you guys come see me do some stand-up comedy. I've got my regular shows in Nashville the first Friday of the month. I do shows at Yazoo Brewing. And then I will be in August 10th. I will be in Charlotte, North Carolina with Aaron Weber, who is a good friend of mine. You may have noticed he edited a couple of our episodes last year. But Aaron is killing it. He just was on the Just for Laughs New Faces lineup, which is a huge deal. A lot of the most famous comics in America come through that. So I'll be featuring for him that weekend. It's an all-clean show in Charlotte. So you can find out about all those shows and all my dates at sawyercomedy.com. And I add them as we go. I'd love to have you come out to a show. And if you do, come holler at me after the show. Always pumped to meet people who listen to this podcast because I'm really grateful for you guys. So that's about it. We now move on to our conversation with Lee McIntyre about how to talk to a science denier. Take care. Lee McIntyre, welcome to The Road to Now.
Thanks very much for having me on. I appreciate it.
Oh, and I appreciate it. Your book is probably the most timely book that could be coming out right now. You know, I mean, honestly, we might have been able to use it a little bit earlier than this, but you've been working on it for a while. You got this book out. It is called How to Talk to a Science Denier, Conversations with Flat Earthers, Climate Deniers, and Others Who Defy Reason. It's coming out August 31st, 2021 through MIT Press. And you are here to answer the question, how do we talk to a science denier? So let's just get into this. How should we do it?
It is very hard to do. The first thing to do is to get over the urge to yell at them, to insult them, to walk away, to have the feeling that this conversation is not worth having. Nothing I say is ever going to convince them. I'm wasting my time. And it's very easy to feel that way when the science denier that you're talking to is not just denying the shape of the earth, but denying to wear a mask or, you know, denying to get a COVID vaccine, which, you know, might kill you or your family. So, you know, it's very, very difficult to put yourself in the frame of mind where you can be cool and calm and respectful. But that is what you have to do to talk to a science denier, no matter what they believe.
Yeah. I mean, we've been dealing with this for years, and I think a lot of us kind of wrote these people off as like, oh, they're crazy, they're nuts. But also, you know, well, we'll just ignore them and they'll go away. And now we're seeing it in a very pressing way, like that type of thinking has very real implications. So my next question would be, you know, why should we then? Why should we?
Because if we don't, the problem will continue to get worse. And I know people think, how could it get worse? It can get worse. I've been studying this stuff for a long time, and it has gotten worse over the 2 decades that I've been studying it. In fact, it's now jumped from science denial to reality denial. They're not, you know, all the science denial that started with, well, you know, we really don't have the definitive evidence to prove that cigarette smoking causes lung cancer. You know, that then rolled into, well, you know, we're going to wait for more evidence on climate change. I mean, those things are bad enough. But what happened is that after 60 years of this, a lot of politicians looked at it and said, huh, look at that. They can deny that. I can deny anything I want. I can deny how many people were at my inauguration. I can deny whether it was raining during my speech or whether I actually lost the last election. Now, you know who I'm talking about. But the point is that it will get worse. And you know, even from here. And so I think that there are several things that we can do. But I think one of the most important things that we all can do is to begin talking to people who disagree with us, because that's really the only way to get them over it. And the other thing, I mean, in terms of advice, and this is really hard, you can't talk about facts because the facts are not why they believe what they believe in the first place. Jonathan Swift said you can't reason somebody out of something they didn't reason themselves into.
Yes.
And you got to remember that the reason they believe that, you know, the COVID vaccine has some microchips in it or, you know, whatever they believe is because they have been fed lies by somebody who is profiting, you know, ideologically or economically from those lies. And if you just provide facts and they don't trust you, they're not going to believe it. So the main reason to be calm and respectful and talk to them face to face is to build trust and to ask questions so that they can convince themselves. Does not always work, but that's the only thing that would work.
Right. And this is, you know, there's so many ways we could take this, because having read the book, you know, my notes are long for this episode. So, you know, the thing I'll say is, this is the hard thing to do, right? Because you say that, like, so many people have approached these folks if I give them the information, right? This whole like data deficit, this information deficit framework. And you say that there's a problem with that, because when you're asking someone to consider the ideas that you have, you're not just asking them to change their mind. You're asking them to change their entire sense of identity.
Yes. And along with that comes to trust you. I mean, most science deniers, I'm going to say virtually all science deniers, are conspiracy theorists. Now, what happens when you say to a conspiracy theorist that they're wrong? They think you're part of the conspiracy and they don't trust you. So, you know, how do you get somebody to trust you? You've got to recognize that at least in part, the reason they don't trust you is because you're threatening their sense of identity. I mean, when you attack somebody's beliefs, you're attacking them as a person, you know, in a case like this, where it's not a rational belief that they can be talked out of with evidence. They believe it, you know, in their heart with no evidence whatsoever. And so when you attack it, you're saying, you know, all the insults that you can imagine about them. And, you know, really in a way I made it harder, didn't I? Because if you think it's hard to change somebody's beliefs, try changing their identity. But, right. but here you catch a break, because people want to connect with other people. And this is why I think it has to be done face to face. You go into the comment section, you know, you're never going to convince anybody. But when you're face to face, you have a better shot, because people are not quite so belligerent. And they, you know, we've evolved to relate to other people face to face.
Yeah. And this is, I think, it's so hard for so many people, because I mean, the internet has made it able to say, you know, it's the whole thing, you know, the old saying, it's like, look me in the eye when you say that.
Yeah.
Right? Well, you don't even have to look at them or know who they are. And it gets into this sense of identity. I was talking to my wife about it last night, to put it in like terms that I think somebody else could get. And maybe this is equally esoteric, but Greg Graffin, the guitar player or the singer for Bad Religion, wrote these great essays on the early punk scene in L.A., and he said it was a place where people who felt left out could come and they belonged. And it's this beautiful essay about what it was.
Yes.
And to try to convince those people that punk sucks, you're not going to. Because if they're convinced of that, they will lose their entire group in the place they belong. And I think this relates to this opening story you have about going to the Flat Earther Conference. And we're trying to pin down what makes somebody go to this conference. And you say, it's a lot of different things, but there's a common denominator.
And that common denominator is that in some sense, they all had felt betrayed by someone in their life who they thought was telling them the truth, and they weren't. So they felt alienated and fractured and hurt, and like they weren't a part of the regular society. And once you feel that way, well, as a human being, you want to feel part of something. And so you go on the internet and you see just how deep this rabbit hole goes of lies and betrayal. One day you happen upon a flat earth video, and then YouTube starts sending you 20 of them, and you don't remember enough physics to know what's wrong with it. Next thing, you're at a flat earth convention, you're with people who tell you that you're smart and you belong, and then you're part of them. And that movement is growing. And I know people make fun of it. It's easy to make fun of it, but it is absolutely growing. And I spent two searing days at the Flat Earth International Conference in Denver in 2018, talking to these folks, 650 of them, who had flown in from all parts of the world to be with other people who believe what they believe. And I wanted to go because I wanted to face science denial at its very worst. And what I found is that they were just like folks that I had met my entire life, except that now they had, you know, something that they didn't have 40 years ago, which was the means to find other people who were also alienated, and they rallied around this belief. It's about community and identity, absolutely.
Yeah, and this is what's interesting to me. I mean, you say in the book that your primary purpose isn't to look into the, you know, who makes these up or the forces behind it. And you kind of, after this conference, as a part of this, you say there's certain, you know, if you really want to talk to people, the key thing you should understand is that there are five things in their reasoning. There are five key elements. And you do, by the way, you do a fantastic job of breaking this down. Yeah. And going through the literature, I mean, everybody in the Academy knows that the literature review is a slog for anybody who's not like in that field, but you made it really delightful.
Oh,
so could you talk about these? Yeah, absolutely. Could you talk about these 5 points?
That's the part that I love, because I'm a scholar in philosophy and science. So going to the literature was easy. Going to the Flat Earth Convention was hard. Yeah, I didn't come up with this with this rubric of the five different tropes of science denial reasoning, but it was due to the Hufnagel brothers and then John Cook and Stephen Lewandowski are cognitive scientists who really popularized it and extended it. But it goes like this. Flat earthers, evolution deniers, COVID deniers, climate change deniers, all of them have the exact same strategy for reasoning. They cherry pick evidence. They believe in conspiracy theories. They rely on fake experts and denigrate real experts. They engage in illogical reasoning, which can be anything from inconsistency to, you know, other things that we can talk about. And here's my favorite. They think that science has to be perfect.
Yes.
So, and that's the one that's actually, to me, the most interesting, because they have this such a vaunted view of science that when scientists betray the slightest bit of uncertainty, they say, aha. And then once they feel, aha, you can't prove it, then they feel like, well, then any view is as good as any other. But that's a radical misunderstanding of what science is. And so when I went to the Flat Earth Convention, I went there to talk to them about that. I didn't come in there with a bunch of facts from, you know, Archimedes. I came in there to talk to them because they'd heard it before. I mean, they knew the history. And if you go in there and you think they don't, you know, you're going to get your pocket picked because they, you know, they have read this stuff and have five reasons why it's a fake. But I went in there to talk to them about, well, you know, you say this is not based on faith. This is based on evidence. So tell me what evidence could convince you that you were wrong. And they went, well, proof. I say proof. That's not how science works. Science, you know, you can't prove that the earth is flat. I can't prove that it's round. Let's talk about evidence. Let's talk about, you know, what you would need in order for it to be probable that you were wrong. What could I show you? They really couldn't do it. And so by focusing in on those five problems, I was able to at least get them to listen to what else I had to say. And also by listening to them, right? I spent the whole first day incognito just listening. But then once I started to engage them, I could ask them questions and they were very willing to talk. I mean, they wanted to convince me I was wrong. So, you know, we were in a debate and they were having fun. So,
yeah, they're nothing if not evangelical.
Evangelical about flat earth, if not other things. Yeah, absolutely.
And you pointed out that like those 2 days, one of the biggest panels on both days was a panel on how to convince people
that
the earth is flat.
That's right.
This is all fascinating. But you say this question, what evidence would convince you that you're wrong about this? And you say like, this is a really good question because it gets the person thinking about the evidence they've seen and what might
That's
be
right.
available. And you have this conversation with the guy. Well, he said, well, you know, if I could see the, and this is to connect it back to the other elements. If I could fly over the South Pole, I would believe there was a South Pole. And then he said, but there's no flight. You said, well, actually, I found one. And then he said he would do it. But then he makes an absolutely just as kind of insane claim. And it's that the every flight that's ever flown was, and every pilot in the world is a part of a conspiracy to make it look like there's a South Pole. I mean, how do you keep your cool with that?
Well, it's you could see on his face that he was having a hard time when he said this to me, because he's a smart guy. He was the one who had just given the panel on how to convert people to flat earth. So he knew how this looked. He knew what I was thinking when he was saying this, because the next words out of my mouth were going to be, well, I guess it is a matter of faith then, isn't it? You know, and he was just waiting for me to stick the knife in, which I didn't do, you know, because I didn't want the dinner to end. I took him out to dinner. We wanted to, you know, continue talking. But I mean, I could see how upset he was that he couldn't answer this. But I remembered that he's a conspiracy theorist and he's a true believer in this. You know, if the, again, if the, he's wrong, this is going to shatter his identity. So, you know, I asked the question in good faith, and it's very hard. I mean, I didn't expect to convert him on the spot, because that is nearly impossible to do.
Yeah.
But what I wanted to do was to do what he was telling the people to do, which is plant the seed of doubt. Plant the seed of doubt and then come back. And that was my mistake. I didn't follow up with him, you know, the next week and the next month. But, you know, I planted the seed of doubt by getting him to question whether it really was a question of faith or evidence, because he couldn't tell me any evidence that would convince him he was wrong.
Right. So this gets at one of the things that has been a pet peeve for me for a long time. And it's this question of how we use the word research. And yes, I have been saying for a long time, that word has gotten really expansive. I mean, that word is elastic at best. You know, is this a problem? Because I feel like we're not teaching people what research is. I've seen, you know, throughout the COVID pandemic, I've seen people saying, hey, it's blah, 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 it's this, it's not real, do the research. And I've always laughed. I'm like, well, yeah, well, sorry, I don't have a lab. I don't have a sample set. You know, I don't have a group of like 300 people willing to undergo some type of experiment. What do you think about this? Like, how do we convince people that going to YouTube is not research?
I mean, that is, you've put your finger, I mean, that's a great question, because you've put your finger on something that I think is a point that we can use in talking to science deniers, because they want to believe in science. They use the jargon of science. They'll say that they're more skeptical than the scientists, that they're better than the scientists. So they talk about doing the research. They talk about evidence, right? And I think that that's an opportunity to give them an education about how science actually works, which I was doing when I was talking about evidence. One thing that I like to talk about with science deniers is justification. Sufficiency. What would be sufficient evidence? You know, I can't prove it, but don't you think the thing that has more evidence is more probably true than the thing that has less evidence? You know, because that's how scientists think about it. Now, when a science denier talks about research, what they mean is going to YouTube. I saw a meme one time, a little, you know, joke. It said, you know, here's vaccine research, and it had a woman with a test tube, you know, in a lab, and it says, here's anti-vax research, and it was somebody looking at their phone, right? that's not research, but I think that you can try to turn the tables and, you know, try to make them better scientists and understand the values of science in that way. One of the most effective strategies is to have them try to convince you. Say, oh, you've done the research? Really? Tell me what you found. You know, convince me. Or, you know, send me the links on that. And then you look at it and you say, well, you know, that person really doesn't have any credentials in this area, you know, rely on fake experts. They say, oh, well, you know, he does have the credentials, but, you know, and then you can get into this conversation about how they're reasoning. I think that's when you're winning. And, you know, to bring it over to COVID for a minute, because flat earth is fun, but COVID denial is, you know, killing us.
Yes.
When you're talking to somebody who, I was watching the tapes the other day of a journalist who was down in Arkansas talking to people who were not wearing a mask and wouldn't take their COVID vaccine. And they said things like, you know, well, I've been fine so far. I've lived my whole, you know, my whole life. Or, you know, I feel healthy. Or, you know, I don't trust the government. Those are all opportunities to follow up, instead of just walking away or saying, you know, you're crazy. I mean, I can't emphasize enough, just having the conversation, giving the person opportunity to talk is important. And the reason I bring this up is not because I was successful at it at Flat Earth, but because other people have been successful at it in the world in getting anti-vaxxers and climate change deniers and others to change their mind. And I talk about examples in the book. This method has actually worked to convince people to give up extreme beliefs.
I just want to take a second here and talk to our friend, Jamie Jeschke from La Cosecha Coffee. Jamie, how are you doing, man?
Real good, Ben. Good to talk to you.
Likewise. You have been sponsoring us 4 years.
we love your coffee. We love what you guys do out there in Maplewood, Missouri, right outside of St. Louis. And one of my favorite things now is that we'll get people who hit us up on social media, unrelated to anything else, and be like, you're right, La Cosecha coffee is so good. So tell us about what you guys are doing.
You know, we're just a small roaster and coffee bar in St. Louis, and we were just wanting to expand our online presence. And I was listening to your podcast, and I you guys approached us about being a sponsor, and I was thinking this would be a good way to get a more national audience. And so, you know, it's taken a while. It's taken some baby steps here, you know, getting where we need to be. But I feel like, especially last year, we just really started getting a lot of your listeners on board with ordering coffee.
That's great. Given the repeat customers, you know, that are coming from Road to Now to you, do you have any suggestions for somebody who really likes La Cosecha coffee, but sometimes we'll forget to order and run out?
Totally. The number one thing that we've noticed that people have enjoyed is our subscription service, and they'll just keep coming to you and you don't have to think about it.
Well, that's awesome, man. I'm glad you could join us. And the website is lacosechacoffee.com. That's LACOSECHA.com. Use promo code RTN10, the number 10, for 10% off your order. So thanks for being here. It's nice to be able to reintroduce you again to our listeners. Have a great day, man.
Yeah, thanks, Ben.
Another issue you talk about in the book is confirmation bias. And, you know, for me, that's that, you know, let's lay this on the table. One of the reasons I might love this book is because it confirms my bias.
I make a good living on confirmation bias, you know?
Well, I feel like this is one that I've been in the minority in, but I have been telling people, and this is the central part of the classes that I teach, when we talk about, you know, controversial issues in the past and all this, I say, look, you've got to listen. And if when you approach anybody with hate, like when you approach them, don't be surprised if someone came over to you, convinced you were an idiot, and started yelling at you about anything.
Yeah. Yeah.
Even if you were wrong, even if you were right, it doesn't matter. You're not going to listen to them. And that if you don't show love to people when you approach them and you show no opportunity for love, why would they ever listen to anything you say?
Yeah.
And so I really love this point of the book. Thinking about this ties into something I was recently reading, and I want to run this by you. Because science denial, it is an interesting thing where it's like, it's not just the right? It's this, you know, this circle comes back around and you've got like the far left, like anti-vax people. But there is a strong part, you know, I would say the base of it is in people who are more on the right wing of the spectrum. I was reading Thomas Piketty's, it was not Capital in the 21st Century, you know, Capital and Ideology. And mm-hmm. he made this point that I feel like people on the left don't get. It was kind of revelatory for me. Mm-hmm. I was thinking about this stuff. But his point is that what a lot of people don't get is that there are two elites in this country. And that when you look at the political spectrum, most people can only see one. So for the left, it's the wealthy. Right. It's the people who have money, who have power, and that's the elite. And the left can't quite wrap their head around why poor folks don't, you know, are so on the side of the people who are so rich. But he points out there's two elites. There is also like what he calls the Brahmin left, an elite whose basis is expertise. And this has converged these folks, you know, allow the folks on the right to converge around this idea that they are not being left out financially because, after all, they could possibly have $1 billion, but they could probably never have a PhD. They could probably never have these college degrees because that's not a path they follow. So when you think about that, do you think that helps us when we try to understand how to talk to these folks?
That's a really fascinating point. People never see, this is cognitive bias 101, people never see the bias that they have themselves. And this is what confirmation bias is all about. You know, people don't like, because it harms our ego, or we just, for whatever reason, we just don't see it. And that's why in the book, I overtly raise the question of whether science denial is only a problem for the right. And it's not. And the reason I did that is because I think that one of the main ways to fight denialist thinking is to fight it in ourselves. about the things that we might be deniers about. But also the reason I brought that up is because once you admit that you can have a blind spot about some issues yourself, it makes you more empathetic toward people who have blind spots about other things, and then you can talk to them, right? If you just feel like you're a Brahmin, you know, you're an elite, you know everything about it, and these people know nothing, then you might not have empathy, or you might feel like they're not worth talking to, they're not educated. But I've been out there, and some of them are, in fact, quite educated, and it's not just a question of education. In fact, there have been some studies which have shown that the more educated deniers are really in some ways the worst ones, right? Because they have the wherewithal to know how to work those, you know, motivated reasoning over to, you know, to say, no, you know I'm right, and I'll give you five reasons why I'm right. And so, I mean, the point that you bring up, I think is really a kind of an important one. Tom Nichols wrote about this in his book, The Death of Expertise. I mean,
great book.
People do not like the elites. And I'm going to have to think about that a little bit more, about this idea about there being two elites, because in my own way in the book, I'm trying to break people out of the idea, because I know my book is probably going to appeal, you know, more to folks on the left. I'm on the left. I want to break them out of the idea that, oh, this is somebody else's problem, or that this is, they're reading the book for the sake of voyeurism. You know, look at what these crazy people think, because we all have our blind spots. And I want people to understand that so that they can fight it in themselves and then help others. I think there has to be a humanity about this too. And this is important. And I did not write about this in the book. People who are science deniers, for the most part, are victims. Because they are being convinced by disinformation. And disinformation is created intentionally by someone for their own interest. And so a lot of the people who are believing, you know, who are COVID deniers, they're not getting anything out of it. They're dying because of it. But the people who are creating the COVID disinformation, they're getting something out of having this army of people polarized on their side. So if that doesn't pull your heartstring to be more empathetic, I don't know what will. I've come to see science deniers more as victims than as bad guys.
Yes. And I couldn't agree with you more. And this is, you know, people who listen to this podcast have heard me say this a lot, but I just want to bring it up again. It's be careful anytime someone is trying to tell you, don't even listen to them. Don't let them talk, right? Yeah. Get away from those people. When they're pushing you apart, it's like, this is a strategy as old as civilization. Yeah. Divide and conquer. I mean, you saw it with segregation, right? Black folks and white people couldn't be around each other, because if they don't talk, then I can tell you what they think. Mm-hmm. And it should be a red flag. As soon as someone says, or you say, there's no use talking to them. You are playing somebody else's game.
And yet that is the number one thing that I hear from my elite friends who don't want to come with me to talk to science deniers. They will say, these people aren't worth talking to. That is the number one thing that I hear.
Think about that sentence, though.
I know.
These people aren't worth talking to
because you can't convince them. They're just going to make me angry. I'm just going to live in my blue bubble. Now, I have to say, my work is at least in part persuasive, not just against the science deniers, but to convince other people to take science denial more seriously and to do their part. And I've had some success with that in convincing some science friends and, you know, other people to, you know, join me in this. And I've been inspired by watching the efforts of other people who have been doing this, you know, long before I got out of my study and started to do it in practice and was, you know, just studying it in theory. I was really impressed by a group that I met up in rural Pennsylvania. I was up there talking to coal miners about climate change, and they helped me put together a group at a restaurant of coal miners. We just had a great conversation. And this husband and wife team, they run something called Hear Yourself Think. They go out to right-wing rallies. They go to Trump rallies and interview people and talk to them. I mean, they're not just journalists. They're they're lobbyists. I mean, they're trying to say to them, no, don't you see? I mean, these people are brave as hell getting out there doing that. And they put it on film and anybody can see it. And they give classes about how to talk to people who disagree with them. So I talked about them in my book. I studied with them a little bit. I took one of their seminars. And so, I mean, there are grassroots efforts of people out there doing this.
And they're working. And again, here's the thing. Some people will go, well, probably not all the time. But isn't that the problem with science denial? The people go, well, science doesn't work all the time. It's our best way. It's the best we know at this point.
What Winston Churchill said, democracy is the worst form of government except for all the others, right? I mean, it doesn't work all the time, but what are you going to do instead? This is the method that's going to work.
Now, I think for a lot of people listening right now, the elephant in the room, and this has actually been something that we talked about, I think last year when we had Tom Nichols on the podcast, this might have come up, this idea that kind of came out maybe a year and a half ago of the backfire effect. The idea that if you tell someone something that's different than what they think, then they are, it's just going to make them believe it harder. And one of the great things about your book is you take us through that story of how they got picked up. Could you share that with our listeners now? Because I'm sure a lot of them who don't want to hear this are going, if I tell them about it, it'll just make them worse.
Okay. The backfire effect has done great damage. Because the backfire effect was this legitimate finding that these researchers, Brendan Knight and Jason Riefler, in an experiment found that when you gave people correct information that challenged, you know, the false thing that they thought was true, a small minority of them were more likely to hold their original belief more strongly. That is to say, they didn't just not give it up, but because you provided them correcting information, they doubled down on the false belief. And the news is that that part of that backfire effect could not be replicated. Other researchers have tried and failed to find it. And even the original researchers have now said that that piece of it where, you know, again, not just that you couldn't convince them to give up their view, but that they double down on it, that they now have retracted that part of it. They think that, you know, they agree with the researchers who couldn't find it, that it replicated, and have gone on. I mean, talk about scientific integrity, right? I mean, bravo.
Yes.
And then they changed their mind on the basis of evidence. Good for them. And then they went on to do more work to talk about, well, okay, so how do we convince people? And there's now some really brilliant work out there, scientifically valid, a carefully done work about what techniques work and what techniques don't in convincing somebody. And what I say to my science friends is, oh, you're going to be a science denier? You're not going to read those papers? Because those papers show you that it is worth talking to these people. So don't tell me that, oh, you feel in your gut that it's not. You're being a science denier. You know, That's what I like to say. So you do not have to worry about the backfire effect. You cannot make it worse by talking to somebody.
Or you can, but it is so slim that it will matter. Because, right, they even found these were outliers in this experiment, right?
Even in the original experiment, they found that it was only hardcore right-wingers and only a few of them that felt this way. And again, they couldn't replicate that. That was just, they said it was a unicorn, right? It came across the field and then it disappeared and they never saw it again. So yeah, go nuts, talk to people, go to the convention, you know, have the difficult conversation with your crazy uncle across the Thanksgiving table. It's worth it.
Yeah. Talking about climate, you know, about science denial, I mean, I have tried to explain to people that I've had good conversations with people who start from that point or start from points that I think a lot of us find to be whether philosophically or morally repugnant. But I've spoken to them as people and I've found that they have, in the course of the conversation, listened. You know, again, you're planting the seed, but you see that the seed is being planted. And I've learned from them and I have had people straight up tell me, no, you didn't. I don't get it.
When I got back from Flat Earth, I went, the first place I went was a party, and I was immediately mobbed by all these people, you know, wouldn't pin me, kind of, you know, no, tell the story, tell it again. Just, I didn't hear it, tell it again. You know, everybody wanted to hear it. But afterward, a couple of them said, well, you know, those people weren't serious. They were just goofing around. They were just trolling you. Because they didn't want to believe that, you know, that this was happening. And it sounds like you experienced the same kind of thing. They didn't want to believe that it was possible. Because if you think about it, if it's possible to have these conversations, then that means that they ought to be out there having them. And they don't want to. And I'm the first to admit, it is uncomfortable. It is really uncomfortable. I mean, I was in a room with 650 people who thought I was nuts. That is uncomfortable. I don't care what the topic is. That is uncomfortable.
Yeah. You even said that, like, there was, you had a bit of a rattling, right? I mean, it rattled you a bit to go through that, kind of like you kept thinking about it.
I'm not going to say I lost my cool because I didn't do anything, but I left the room at one point when I got, I did get upset inside because it was a session on how to convert children to Flat Earth.
Yeah.
That really, I'm a dad, and that really upset me because the adults there were all, I mean, in fact, one thing they'd say to me is, oh, we used to be a globalist just like you, you know, and then we found the YouTube videos. And I thought, well, okay, they changed their mind. Maybe they can change it back. But if you indoctrinate a kid, maybe they don't have a chance in life. And so
yeah.
that's when I became convinced that they were doing real damage. I mean, because some other people say to me, oh, you know, what an indulgence to go to Flat Earth. These people aren't hurting anyone. But
yeah.
I think that they're hurting the kids, and I think they're creating a denialist culture. Plus, people who believe one conspiracy theory tend to believe 20 of them. And some of them that I spoke with thought that Sandy Hook was a hoax and, you know, other things that were absolutely repugnant. And so I don't think you can just say, oh, just let it go. You know, just let it go.
Right. And you say, and this is, you know, you just pointed this out, this statement you put forward, which is that if you want to know if someone's likely to believe in a conspiracy theory, ask yourself if they believe in a different conspiracy theory. Because as you say, the reasoning and the way kind of the song is structured the same for all of them. So do you think that if you could talk to someone and kind of get in their heads about, you know, get in their heads, that sounds like nefarious, but like you could get them to understand the flaws in this reasoning. Do you think it's almost like an inoculation against other potentially more dangerous conspiracy theories?
It could be. I mean, I've got a friend, Andy Norman, just wrote a book called Mental Immunity, in which he's making the argument that you can inoculate yourself or others against this, you know, this kind of thing. Look, conspiracy theory is a great example. This is high risk. Okay, you're walking without a net here. But what if you ran into somebody who was a conspiracy theorist and you said, okay, well, why aren't you a flat earther then? That's the ultimate conspiracy theory. They might say, what are you talking about? And say, well, you know, think about it for a minute and let them argue against it and then realize that that's the same argument that you just made against them, right? And I mean, there is a way. Now, again, that's high risk because you might convince them to become a flat earther, right? If they're that tenuous a grip on reality, right? But the point, I mean, one reason that I wanted to go to the Flat Earth Convention is because they were using the same blueprint as climate change deniers. And I thought that if I studied it in its most elemental form, I could go back and talk to the climate deniers and say, don't you guys realize that you're using the same reasoning strategy as the flat earthers? Do you really want to be associated with that? Now, as it happened, I never got a chance to say that because the coal miners that I spoke to all believed in climate change, which just blew me away. So I didn't get to use any of that, you know, on them. But it was fascinating to me to hear what they had to say.
One of the things that I've started doing in class is a couple of years ago, I invented a conspiracy theory. It was when we were drive out to California. And my conspiracy theory was that, and I tell this in the classroom very I'll start off and I'll say, all right, I'm going to tell you guys a conspiracy theory that I made up while I was riding across the country, right? And I open with that and I say, okay, look, you know, 40 years ago, NASA discovered that there was something heading towards Earth. They couldn't see what it was. And, you know, as it's gotten closer, there's like several units. They're not sure if it's a, you know, they begin to wonder if it's a ship or something. Like, but, you know, they had to prepare Earth, but they couldn't let people know because they would freak out. So have you ever noticed how there are these cell towers everywhere? Right. And like, they're everywhere and they're trying to disguise them as trees. And they say they're for cell phones, but cell phones don't communicate with those towers. They communicate with satellites. So why would they need these towers everywhere? Well, it's a shield.
Oh, you got me thinking now.
So I tell it like I'm a storyteller. I'm a teacher. So like I tell it. And when I say, you know, and it, they're expecting, they're not sure, but that whatever it is will be here within 4 to 5 years. I end that. And I look at a group of people that I began saying, hey, here's a conspiracy theory I made up in my car right across the country.
And they're going.
And there's always several of them going, oh, my God. At the end, they're like, what? And I'm like, I just told you I made that up. And they're like, oh, and everybody laughs. Like, you build the tension, you release it. And I say, well, here's the thing. If you talk to anybody, they would know these do communicate with cell phone towers, right? Because the amount of, as one person told me, who was a physicist, was like, the amount of radiation a phone would produce, which was going straight to a satellite, would, like, and something this small would just fry your brain. And I said, but if he said that to me, I would be like, of course he says that. He works for the cell phone company. He's in on the conspiracy.
See, and you put your finger right on it. See, because you had a good answer. But if you didn't trust the person who was giving you the answer, if you worked it into a conspiracy theory, then you might say, you know, oh, well, you know, maybe that's right. I mean, do you know about the conspiracy that birds aren't real?
No,
now,
oh my God.
This was a farce. This was a parody, yeah. Just like you did in your car. Somebody made up, to see how far they could push it, made up a parody conspiracy theory that birds had all died 30 or 40 years ago and that the birds now in the sky were government drones that were spying on us. And wouldn't you know, there are now some people who actually believe this, even though it was a parody, even though it was, you know, not just tongue in cheek. I mean, just obviously false. The people who made it up said they didn't believe it, but there are people who are now believing it. So you have to be careful. You have to be careful. You have to be careful with conspiracy theories in particular. There's a terrific book on this by one of my friends who's got the coolest name ever, Kassim Kassam. C-A-S-S-A-M, Kassim Kassam, wonderful name, Conspiracy Theories. And, you know, he goes into this issue about evidence. I mean, the problem with conspiracy theories is if there's any evidence for them, they'll take it. If there's no evidence for it, that just shows how smart the conspirators are. You can't, yeah. You know, you can't push them out of it. But here's what you can do. Like I said, like you did, ask them, well, why don't you believe this, this, and this conspiracy? You know, make up a whole bunch of other ones that they don't believe. And then ask them why not. Plant that seed of doubt.
Yeah, and you can do it, and do it with love and do it with grace. Now, I want to wrap up here asking you this question. You've pointed out in this conversation how many times your work makes you very uncomfortable and sends you into places where you are surrounded by hundreds of people who think you're the idiot. What led young Lee McIntyre into a life of going into these uncomfortable places, hopefully to make us a little bit better?
I don't know. I don't enjoy it, and I can't really explain it. I guess what I'll say is this. I thought when I was a kid, I always admired scientists and thought, oh, I was born too late. You know, all the great truths and defensive reason has been discovered. There aren't any, you know, people against this now. And then when it happened in my lifetime, I thought, well, damn, it's my turn. I got to, you know, get out there. And I did study this from, you know, my office for an awfully long time before I got out there. What happened is that I wrote a book called The Scientific Attitude about what's special about science. And I was touring talking about this book. And this was when Trump was president and people were saying, you know, well, what can I do? How can I, you know, get the word out? I said, well, talk to people who disagree with you. And I realized, why am I not doing that? And on a lark, I went to the internet and I found that there was a Flat Earth conference in Denver and it was coming up. And I said, why don't I just go? Why don't I just see what it's like to actually do it? I mean, I'm recommending other people do it. I've been spent my whole adult life studying this. Let me go do it. And there was no going back after that. It was just, it was amazing to do it. I mean, again, I didn't enjoy it, but it was... I wanted to do it again. I wanted to see if I could get better at it.
Yeah. I don't enjoy brushing my teeth, but if I don't do it,
yeah.
It's worse.
No, but this is great. And you know, you're a philosopher, right? A philosopher of science.
I am.
And so how does one start that path? I mean, even to get to where you were, where you could offer this, you know, what was it that drew you to this field?
Most philosophers of science don't do what I do. I mean, I was an academic philosopher of science for years, and then I became what's known these days as a public philosopher. I got interested in how philosophy could help us think about, you know, the kind of problems that people were worrying about in, you know, their regular lives. And when it started to be that science denial was so bad, I thought, well, I've been preparing my whole life for this moment, you know?
Yeah.
And this was part of what was motivating, that other philosophers of science weren't out there doing this. You know, it's easy to be right when you're in a classroom full of students who you're grading, you know, but when you get out there in a group of people who tell you you're an idiot, that's not so easy. And it's really attractive to, you know, go running back to the university, which is why a lot of people don't do it. But I want to be out there as kind of an example. And I also want to recruit other people to do what I'm doing. And the other piece of it is that I just can't stand it. I just can't stand the idea that I feel like the world is in trouble and I'm not doing anything about it. You know, COVID denial, election denial, everything that's going on, if I've got something that I can do to help, even if it's not going to work, that's how I justify my life, my time, my work. I want to be out there trying to do something.
Yeah, and if it doesn't work, it's like I constantly remind my students when they're trying to tell them to be ambitious. It's if you work on it and it doesn't work, well, guess what? You still got what you had already, right? You're still there, right? So that you can only gain. And I just want to say that you know, I feel like you're doing it. If people read this book, the examples in there, the embedded lesson that you have to learn grace and you have to learn humility and you have to practice love to speak to people, that it works. And the book is How to Talk to a Science Denier, Conversations with Flat Earthers, Climate Deniers, and Others Who Defy Reason. It's coming out August 31st from MIT Press. You can pre-order it now. So go ahead and get ready to get it, listen to it, and practice it. Because you know what? You don't have to sit in a room. You listen around. You don't have to sit in a room with 650 flat earthers to get these lessons. So Lee McIntyre, thank you so much for your time. Thank you for what you're doing. And thank you for providing us with this handbook for how to maybe make things better.
I really appreciate it. How much fun was this program? I really enjoyed talking to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Lee. Thank you for listening to another episode of The Road to Now. The Road to Now is hold on a second. Have you given us 5 stars on Apple Podcasts yet? Have you written a review? If not, would you please do that? It helps a lot. It helps spread the word, helps us get the word out there. And we'd really appreciate that. Anyway, back to it. The Road to Now is hosted and produced by Bob Crawford and me, Ben Sawyer. Our associate producer and the editor of this very episode is Gary Fletcher. Our theme music today, like almost always, is by Paul DeFiglia. We'd like to say a special thanks to our supporters on Patreon, with a special shout out to our Washingtonians, Tanya Marsh, Mary Hocking, Paul Ayler, Tim and Caitlin Wells, Fig White, Peggy Donica, Matt Williams, T. Martin, Julia Adams, and Ann Williams and Frank Edwards. We'd also like to give a special shout out to our 2 newest supporters at the Lincoln tier, Hannah Grace Kelly and Dan Broughton. Thanks for joining us, guys. If you'd like to join us on Patreon, you can be in the Zoom room for our live recordings. You can be part of our third Thursday trivia nights. You can get bonus content. Just go to patreon.com/theroadtonow. If you just want to go to our regular website, that's cool too. Go to theroadtonow.com. That's www.theroadtonow.com. You can search our back catalog. You can find quick links to content. You can even listen there. And you're going to wonder, why is this so good? And the answer is because it was designed by 7 Ages Design. If you're looking for a website, hit up Charles and Destiny. They're great. That's 7 Ages Design. For Bob Crawford, this is Ben Sawyer. Thank you for listening and take care.